This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Hi, everybody. How's it going? Anybody have any questions?
So, I mean, at the beginning of the summer, people were excited about Iron Man, but it really hit a lot bigger than I think almost anybody expected. Were you surprised, or would you know America needed Tony Stark?
I was surprised that it made... I was surprised by everything. I was surprised that the reviews were so strong. Then I was surprised that it made so much money. And then I was surprised that Dark Knight had better reviews. And that it made so much more money. So it was... on the one hand, it was very... It was really an unexpected, serendipitous summer for me. And on top of that, it was like surprising at just how history had been made by this other movie as well. And oddly, when Dark Knight finally came out and was received the way it was such a relief for me, because I really felt like we went from nobody expected anything to people started to expect something to... This is new phenomena where they report what they project based on tracking what your movie's going to make. So we could have made, you know, $20, $30 million less than we'd opened to. Had been a huge hit, but being perceived as a failure because we didn't live up to the expectations based on the people who were reading that data. It wasn't long ago they would never even report what the number one movie was. Now the top 10 box office is in USA Today. And now it's hitting this point where this real inside baseball tracking and projections and all of these between the HXX and the movie mogul, what's it called? There's another site where you play the game.
The fantasy
mogul type sites. They start, you know, those people are starting to, with their blogs, getting out there, and those numbers seep into the mainstream Hollywood websites, and it's becoming one big, you know, bolus of information out there that you really can't escape from. So first it was, you know, who the hell cares about Marvel's B-level heroes that they're marching out when they first announced we're making the movie? Right. To Comic-Con, where it started building momentum a year later, to this fever pitch, to this point where we were really scared that we were going to disappoint, to the point where we outdid those expectations, and so we're there sort of, you know, teetering on the brink, and then Dark Knight comes in and just, you know, makes history, and all of a sudden that, you know, the relief of that spotlight, like moving off of us from the guard tower, and now we have 2 years to lay low and really work on the movie without the type of scrutiny that we were feeling right in that white-hot moment after we came out.
John, why is this period of time that we are living so prolific, so good for superhero movies? Why do you think that all of this is happening?
I think 9/11. I think you know, aptly today we're meeting, but I think it changed. That was a game changer. I think people were looking for emotional simplicity, escapism. And if you look at it, I think there were superhero movies before Spider-Man, but that first Spider-Man was hitting right, I think, right in May 2002, when it was the first way that we can get to those emotions. Because you couldn't say anything about politics, you couldn't say anything about war, people just didn't want to deal with it. But you put people in a costume, this is the good guy, this is the bad guy, and you either set it in a fantasy world like Lord of the Rings or in the Marvel Universe. All of a sudden you allow people and kids and adults to experience those emotions in a way where they don't feel like they're, you know, they're dealing with very real emotions in a very escapist way. And I think that has become more and more complex as we've become more and more comfortable with where we are in the world now, whatever it is, 7 years later. And you could have a movie like The Dark Knight where you start to deal with those things, where you could show people on a battlefield in Afghanistan like in Iron Man. There's a line you can't cross, but that line's moving. And I think there's going to be a new... You know, I'm glad that I was able to hit the crest of this genre. And I feel safe because now we have a built-in audience. I think we'll do well with our sequel. But you wonder when that how that is going to change, because whoever gets voted in, you have probably the most extreme contrasting figures that both political parties have to offer to what we currently are experiencing. So I think there's going to be an incredible transformation. I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know how the economy is going to affect that. I don't know what the politics are really going to look like, but I know that something, a change is coming one way or the other. And, you know, they say one is change, one. I think they're both. I mean, McCain has always been the guy who was really the outsider within that party. So I think even if McCain wins, you're going to see incredible movement, incredible change within our political system and our culture. And so I wonder, as a movie maker, how that's going to affect audiences, what they like, and what the attitude is. But I don't think it's something that turns on a dime. But I think, you know. But then again, I'm not going to be sitting here in front of you for another 2 years till the other movies, you know, Iron Man 2's coming out. And I think by then the dust will have settled a little bit, and it'll be very interesting how to handle that.
How has Marvel's plan to have this sort of integrated movie universe been a game changer for your plans, going from a franchise to a sort of a mega franchise?
It's tough, because it first starts off as, hey, wouldn't it be fun if we stuck a Captain America shield in the background? Wouldn't it be fun if we have Sam Jackson play Nick Fury like in the Ultimate Avengers? That would be, it's like, let's prove ourselves to our fans. And so you do that. Then now, between the Captain America shield, Nick Fury, and then the after the credit scene that in the 11th hour became the final scene of the Hulk, that's it. That one was a big one for me. I was like, wow, we're forming a team. You're going to that guy and you're forming a team. That's not, it's clearly not the day after Iron Man ended. You know, where does it fit in the time continuum? How do you, and I don't want to just ignore it or do what the comic books have done. I guess you could, as Marvel say, it's an alternate universe. No, but you know, they've gotten away with that one for a couple decades. But how do you make it all work within that world? Because I think it is fun, and I think Hulk was successful in keeping a tone that did not seem inconsistent with our film, and certainly with Robert being in there. But we definitely now have a lot of things. And look, I come out of improv, and improv, you say, okay, give me a suggestion of a place, give me a line of dialogue. Well, here it's like, give me three scenes that I have to incorporate into my next movie. And so it is a challenge, but it's a challenge that is, it's, what's refreshing is I don't go back, and it's not like you got a studio executive who could care less, saying, well, what the, they don't give a shit, just whatever, make, you know, whatever tests best. In this case, you have Kevin Feige, who's like, how are we going to solve this puzzle? It's like a Rubik's Cube to them as well. And just all that brain power addressing something, it makes you come up with interesting solutions. And so we have a pretty good game plan. And then there's conversations that I've been having with them about the Avengers, too. Because remember, for Avengers, you're not just dealing with tech. You're dealing with interdimensional portals and all the shit that makes you jump the shark if you don't handle it right. So, you know, we were very restrained in how we used our superheroism in our movie. And we did that by keeping it all tech-based. And then Hulk went a little bit, it's still kind of tech-based. You get into Cap, you start saying, okay, a guy frozen in a glaze. Okay, I could maybe buy that with the super soldier thing. And then you get into Thor, and it's like, okay, what do we, you know, how do you make that all feel of the same world as our movie does? And that's going to be the challenge moving forward, I think.
Well, it's funny because you sort of skirted around that with Iron Man, because you had originally talked about you wanted to have the Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in the film, but the Ten Rings are obviously mm-hmm. a reference to the Mandarin, so you sort of have that in that you could open the fantastical stuff if you wanted to follow that.
It is. It's the Mandarin is such a, you know, it's such a tricky character for us, because everywhere you turn, it's a minefield. Okay, so getting to the mystical Asian, you know, dark arts and interdimensional travel and all the rings that do the different things and the psychic abilities and stuff, and well, like, that could be cool. Maybe it's cool. Maybe if we really, you know, make it authentic. And And then we see the trailer for the Mummy movie. It's like they got the Mandarin and Fing Fang Foom in that thing. And they shot it in China, and it's like as authentic as you're ever going to get. And it's like, ooh, that's kind of, I don't know if that fits our film. It was great for The Mummy, but so where do you go with it? You know, do you make, you know, so it just what are your rules and how do you stay consistent with them? Because that's what happens. People get desperate as they're looking for inspiration and to up the ante, and so you start breaking your own rules, and that's when the movies start to lose their identity.
People had said that the other night when you did the commentary that you had hinted about the Mandarin possibly in the third film.
Yeah, we're the Mandarin's still the guy, you know. He's the main guy. But we always remind ourselves nobody likes the Emperor compared to Darth Vader in the Star Wars movies. And he's got the same lightning bolts and the same, oh wow, thank you. It's like a cheeseburger like in the movie. That's great. That's perfect. Good, so then we'll, great, and we'll get pictures of me with food all around me. Thank you so much.
It's like you're on TV again.
It is like dinner for five, that's right. I'm used to this. I know enough not to eat when they're filming me. But when the Mandarin was when the Emperor was this figure that you just saw obliquely, it was like, shit, Darth Vader's bowing to someone? That's like, that guy must be really cool. But then as he talked more, it's like, all right, enough. And now in, like, the Clone Wars cartoon, he's like a sidekick. So it's really all how you treat the person, and that's what informs what it is. And so the Mandarin, to have that kind of, you know, that kind of weight to him, it's really a matter of using all the narrative tricks to do it. But a dude jumping around in robes with shooting, you know, these, you know, beams and rays that have powers that really, if you take them literally, would throw off the balance of the whole universe. How do you keep the whole thing together, but yet fulfill the expectations from the book? So we do have him, and I think it's something that a little bit goes a long way. And so there's a lot of other characters and a lot of other countries that have become very interesting lately that fit very well into our universe. You know, Iron Man is becoming, the Iron Man canon is becoming incredibly cogent and applicable once again.
How's the writing coming along?
Huh? Writing's really coming along quite well. We got Justin Theroux working on it, who he echoes Downey's tastes a lot. They had worked together on Tropic Thunder. He's an actor. So I come at writing the same way he does. And so he brings a real sense of fun. He's never worked in the genre before, and so he has that great newcomer's enthusiasm that I think we still share. And then it's about, okay, here are the books, here's what we got, here's the story. And so we're breaking story, and pages are coming out, but it's really more of a conversation than actual writing. The pages come, but the pages are never really what they are going to be in the movie, up till the day you're shooting, even on ours. But
say what pages they are, what comic book?
Which pages of which comic book? No, we're making our own. Although I tell you which ones we're looking at very closely, not so much for story, but for tone and the way it's been executed is the Matt Fraction stuff. Because I think that I haven't talked to him yet, but we want to talk to him and get him out here, get Adi out here, you know, get some of the real defining minds from the books. But the Fraction series seems to be informed as much by our movie as it is by what had happened with Iron Man before. So it's a very curious combination. And, you know, look, I'm dabbling writing the Viva Las Vegas books, and it's fun. Then I read what he does. It's like, wow, this guy's really treating it like with the seriousness that you would a movie or a book. And for me, it's like, oh, all the stuff I can't do in a movie, it's fun to write and see what Adi comes up with drawing. But there's a different approach. The Fraction series is informed by, you know, current events and what's going on in the world. I'm very impressed by what he's written.
There's two major parts of the Iron Man mythology. the demon in the bottle storyline, the alcoholism, and being replaced at some point by Rhodey. And now, do you have to look at that and say, okay, do we want to cram everything into one, or save one for another movie?
You can't. Yeah, there's always the sense of, let's save something for another movie, but I think that there's a way to wade into it. And if it's done right, it's, you're not going to have to turn on a dime. I know in Spider-Man, it seems to be dealing with different issues each film, because they're very modular. Ours, we wanted to sort of stretch it out, more like three chapters of the same story. You know, there was a sense, even though I know they shot Lord of the Rings and reshot and did things, there still was a sense that there was an underlying movement of Aragorn to becoming king, you know. And but you watch the first movie or read the first book, it's like, oh, who is this mysterious guy, this Han Solo type character? You're like, great. And as you add more detail to it, he becomes a little bit less interesting for me, but yet consistent in the story. And then you see, you feel like you're being taken on a journey. And I know from watching, I really like long form storytelling. I love television. I mean, not all television, but I really love certain TV shows. And the ones that I like, I really, really like even more than movies, because you're able to tell stories. It's not like a haiku poem where you're just telling the story in an hour and a half. You have a long time. And I really liked Heroes, the first season of Heroes. And I'll watch a thing back to back. I'll just get a box set or download it and just watch the whole deal. And I really look forward to it. And it shows you that. I remember like Twin Peaks, and to some extent, there are certain times in Lost where I felt a little lost. Like, well, where's this going? Do they know where it's going? And it's very compelling. But there's something, and part of that show is the mystery of that Twilight Zone type thing. And it does circle back around, and it rose to the challenge eventually. But in the beginning, it felt like I didn't know if they knew where they were going. And certainly Twin Peaks was like that. Twin Peaks very much was like, everybody loved it until they realized, wait a minute, this is, you know.
you're just making this up
as you go, I know more about this than you do. But then you see a show like Heroes, where it all comes together at the end. It feels like you've been rewarded for paying attention this whole time through. I think the cable shows have that sense, whether it's Sopranos or Weeds or even Californication. There's a sense of using a much larger thing. And you have very smart audiences that have a tremendous capacity to remember things and have complex storytelling. And you see it more in TV series and in video games now. Movies are kind of what they are. You kind of have your, it's like a rock and roll song. You got your thing, your bridge, and your end, you know, and you got to fit that format. And it's very populous and very accessible to everybody. So how do you keep making rock and roll songs, but how do you do, you know, whatever, the White Album? How do you put it all together with other movies and make it something that's a larger experience for people who are paying attention, but yet not so complex that if you're not paying attention, you're going to not have fun? And I found myself in a lot of the sequels, not this last year, but the year before, of movies that I really liked, and having not gone back and watched the other ones, being a little bit lost as to what was going on. And I'm a movie maker. I mean, I'm a pretty smart audience member, and I just don't have that attention span in that. But I want to figure out if I could maybe get a better version of that going while still making it, while still upping the ante with how much you're putting on the screen and the humor and the dialogue and living up to everything people would come to expect from the last movie we made.
One of the interesting things with the first Iron Man is that you end with this battle that's essentially it's a brawl. I mean, you end up with two guys punching each other, hitting each other with big cars or whatever, but it's, you know, it is a very street level, one guy on one guy brawl. Are you looking in the sequel to sort of transcend that and go bigger with the
I am.
Stuff?
I am. I mean, a lot of that was, truth be told, came from the fact that we were being very ambitious as far as what we were going to accomplish for the amount of money we had. So we went forward with the plan of let's shoot as much practically as we can, which I'm on board for, because I like that, and with the Stan Winston suit and the way it was designed, and let's see what we could accomplish with it. Well, the Mark I, we got a lot accomplished with. I'd say 90% of what you see in there is the suit, with a little bit of wire removal or removing the hoses for the flames, but a lot of that was practical. And certainly it was just augmentation. By the time you got into the Mark II, you were doing a lot of flying, and we handed off even more, and the suit that they built was great reference for ILM. But then when we got into the stuff with him fighting with the real suit, it just looked terrible. It looked like Power Rangers. And and there was always the money for the real suit to be replaced. I mean, they always had it to the side, and we finished on time and on budget, so we had money left over to do that. And the problem is you start to replace, even though you're using a CG suit, the plates and the action are still based on what somebody was going to do on the ground. So it's sort of a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it's a bummer because we would have liked to have had more of the flying, and we did add one sequence where they went up into space, but it just sort of didn't really, I think, sing as well as it could have had we planned originally to have it that way. But the good news is that it was successful. People liked it because of the characters and the emotion and ultimately what the whole of the film was. And it left us a lot of room to improve upon it for next time around. And that's another big challenge, is how do you outdo yourself? Because when you go to here, then you got to go further, and then you're going to start it's just going to lose your personality. So it's so nice to have succeeded with a very, with humble beginnings as far as the action goes. And now I've learned a lot more. The last thing we shot, the reshoots, were the sequence, which used to be second unit, but then we went out there with a unit and shot it, and with the part where the hostages were being taken and the guns came out of the shoulders. So I think we found the personality in the sense of humor of the action. And I found a way to be smart and clever about that, I think. And that was always my problem, is that when you cut to the action, I always felt like, okay, now have them hit each other. And every movie you look at, even the good ones, it's tough to get away from that. I mean, whether it's the new Batman or, you know, all the way, you know, which is sort of the gold standard. But if you look at it, it's still, there's just, at a certain point, it's people fighting. You know, it's just people going at it. And you got to do a good job of it and have it coordinated well. You know, all the way down to Blade, and you know, and which also I think the action is very inspired in. But even the movies like the Fantastic Four movies, it's basically the same thing happened. They punch each other, they fall off the thing, they fall into the garbage truck, and you got if you remove it, it's not a superhero movie anymore, because there are people who will go to see that, and that's what's going to make people come to your trailer, and that's what's going to make you open big enough to have the budget that you need to do it right.
One of the secrets of the success of Iron Man was the casting of Robert. Mm-hmm. How much collaboration are you going to be doing with him in developing the sequels?
I was at his house yesterday, and he's getting ready to go do Sherlock Holmes. He's leaving Sunday. He went to Japan briefly to promote this movie there, Iron Man. But, you know, it clearly, you know, we met Justin through him. He really thought the world of him from that process, and there was a lot of writing going on the set there too. And there were things, you know, what do you want to play, Robert? What should we do? How could we? Because Robert was very collaborative on the set of writing it, making it, and all the choices. And part of my gig is to not just ask him to stand on his mark, but to learn. To bring enough of his reality into it that it seems interesting and have more dimension. So he's been very involved. And his star has only risen, and his leverage is only greater. And now he's not the guy who's, please, you know, let me screen test. Now he's the guy who's, like, you know, being offered every movie in town. So
going back to what you said earlier, the point you make now, which is that, you know, whether they're big actors when they come into the property or whether they're sort of made huge actors by being in the property.
Right.
And looking down the line at all of these movies and thinking about ways to incorporate them even into a possible Avengers film.
Right.
Are you sort of logistically concerned with, you've got huge stars and huge characters, and mm-hmm. are you concerned that will ever get in the way if they all appear in sort of one film or start sharing screen time?
I mean, that's the
storytelling.
That's sort of the danger, isn't it? Forget about creatively, just from a perspective of finances. But they're, you know, somehow they make Ocean's 11, so they're clearly business models, and I think it has more to do with if people are enthusiastic and feel that they're going to be in a movie they'll be proud of. The truth is, most stars of that level would love to be in a movie where they're not every day on the call sheet, and they're not the only one carrying the burden for the press junket. For me, I get a kick out of this. I like it. But Robert, you know, now that he's working his ass off because of his success, we just got finished going around the world for 3 weeks. And it was, to me, I mean, it's like very difficult, but it's also, when it's a novelty, it's like you just won a game show. You know, it's like that's what they would give away on The Price is Right. Like a world tour, you will try and fly on private jets with movie stars and meet the main people in every country and eat at the best restaurants and have security details with you in Mexico and be taken to the private tour of the Coliseum in the half an hour you have off between that and going to the premiere on the red carpet of the thing and just cameras going off in your face everywhere and everybody like giving you shit and then when I walk away from Gwyneth and Robert, they chase Gwyneth and Robert and I get to be with my wife in the hotel room in the robe. And so it's really quite wonderful, but it just drains everything out of you. And then, you know, I'm good for 2 years, and then I'll do it again. You know, it'll be fun, and maybe it'll get boring at a certain point. It's not yet, especially because I don't like to fly, so it's really not boring. It's very exciting. It's like going to Six Flags for 3 weeks for me. But Robert gets off it, and then boom, now he's promoting Tropic Thunder. And then he's going to be shooting Sherlock Holmes, and he's going to be promoting something else. And it's like Cameron Diaz said, she says, they don't pay me to do the movies, they pay me to do the press junkets. and so it's very, very difficult on the guy. And what's the worst part is that you have everybody is going so far out of their way for you, and anybody else would jump at this that it seems like heaven. And here you are feeling drained and complaining about something that anybody else would give their pinky for. So you don't feel justified in your frustration with it, and then you really feel like you've completely there's no sympathy for you whatsoever. So you feel very lonely.
Well, speaking of frustration, I'm curious because you're coming back for two.
We're going to film me eating?
You're coming back for two in 2 years. I'm assuming that you're planning on coming back for three. You're going to have to spend maybe a decade in Tony Stark's world.
Yes.
As a filmmaker, is there a thing like you're like, I'd really like to slip one more in there for just, you know, my own thing? Or are you ready to just do 10 years?
It's one day at a time, and here's the funny thing that happens, right? This next one's going to be good because the next one is like, okay, now I could really, creatively, I've got a lot of room.
Right.
They'll pay me well if it does well. I know everybody, and everybody can't wait to see it.
Right.
And on top of that, as a fan of these types of films, not necessarily the genre completely. I mean, it's very hit or miss for me, but I'm definitely part of the audience. If it's good, I'm there. But I'm not going to go just because there's... But I noticed that there's a pattern that the second one, the sequels are usually better than the first ones. Because you don't have the origin story, you have that. And it's been proven again with Dark Knight, right? You got X-Men 2, Spider-Man 2, Dark Knight. When you get into threes, it gets weird. Right. It's real hit or miss. And fours, well, you know, it's even harder. So how do you avoid the mistakes of others? But I don't really have to go there yet. I'm like, now's the time when I know who this guy is. They trust me as a director. The studio needs this to, you know, this is their, they're just as excited about this as I am. And everybody's waiting to see what we do next. So there's like when I was a guest when I was Eric the Clown on Seinfeld. There was a feeling on that set like you could do anything, say anything, and everybody was waiting to see what was going to happen next. And I was like I got to live a week in that world. And it was just, you felt like you were part of this cultural phenomenon. Well, here we are. You know, Swingers was fun, but it came and went. You know, Elf was fun, it came and went. You know, and if you did sequels to either of those, it would feel like you're double dipping. And it always gets worse. But this type of franchise, it can get better because it's meant to be a franchise. So it never feels like you're chasing it. So at this point, we're good. Now, as far as three goes, it becomes harder because you're scared. Then they start offering you a lot of dough. because the truth is, every job I get, I feel like I have more dough than I ever thought I would have.
Right.
So it's not like I don't have enough and I'm not competitive in a way. It's like, I want a plane like him or I want that. My thing is, I'm scared. I want to make sure my family stays together. I don't want to miss half a year of my kid's life. I want to... You know, I want to enjoy every moment so that I don't feel like I don't want to hit the traps that these other people around me are hitting. And that becomes a challenge because there's, you know, you want to do all this stuff. You want to go away and do this. There's temptation in every aspect of the world all around you. But for the most part, they suck you in through the thing that you're most inclined to do, which is you want to do this for a living. Right. You lived on a futon and ate ramen noodles for years just so you could have these opportunities, and now you're going to say no to them. But if you say yes, then you could lose something else that you've grown to really appreciate too, which is your life and the people around you that you love and your kids, and half the people lose that in chasing their career. And there's no real people to look at to show you how to handle it right. So for the third one, you're asking yourself, okay, what are they asking of me? What is there left to say? What am I doing this for? And then there's a lot of pressure on you to do it. And I think it continues as it goes on. What's nice about this is with the Avengers, you have other characters coming in and out, and that's going to change the dynamic of it too. And I think there's also would be more of a sense of fun at that point in doing it, because you're going to start to get more playful with the whole thing. But to answer your question, I would love to work for 10 years on one successful LA-based franchise with people that I really like and connect with, telling stories that I think have some social and emotional resonance, but they aren't so heavy-handed that it's not just about fun. And then I get to play with all the toys and the new CG and the new and building sets and costumes and all the stuff that I would love reading about in Starlog. I get to do in the meetings. So this is a very, and I don't think it's by accident I ended up here. I think I worked hard and I always knew this was something I would love to be. This is the perfect situation right now.
Could you give us an update on how you and Governor Schwarzenegger were working on trying to keep the production here in California?
Yeah, it's very difficult because Arnold, as you know, was an actor and would shoot in L.A. And he deferred some of his upfront pay on the last Terminator film that he was in to keep the production here. So I always felt that he was a guy committed to the same things I was. I have in my contract now I won't shoot outside of L.A. On Elf, I had wanted to shoot here, never put it in writing, and a couple weeks before we started, they said before we greenlit, they said, if you want the green light, you have to move to Canada. And I missed 6 months of my kid's life, and it was really depressing, and I love the movie, but the experience of making it was very lonely, and you come back and you wonder if you still have your family. It's very, very debilitating, unless you have somebody who travels with you, and that's very hard on them. And they can't have a career, and your kids can't go to school with continuity. And I don't want to selfishly put them through that, just so I could see them for the half an hour that I'm actually awake and at home during the working day when you're directing. And so it's like I'm in a position now where I'm using my leverage to be able to shoot at home. And there are a few actors that do. I mean, a few directors that do. I know J.J. does it. I think Spielberg does it for the most part. You know, we might shoot location, but you base out of here. So when the governor was reelected, I went down there because I had always thought he would push through that legislation. Nothing had happened. And I went down there, I didn't know anybody, shook his hand, talked to his people, got his business cards. I said, hey, I want to get involved. What can I do to help? Well, we tried it already. It got shut down. There's nobody wants to give a tax break for movies. They see it as, you're kicking back money to these rich studios. What, there's other places the money could go. And I'm like, the studios are still making the money. The studios aren't getting the money. It's not me. It's not the directors. It's not the actors. We're still getting the money above the line. It's the people who are working in town that don't. It's the people who open up the sandwich shop. The dry cleaners, those are the people. There are 40 films, I think, are shooting in Michigan. Where'd they come from? They came from here. So it seems very short-sighted because you're losing net income, even though you might, let's say you knock down the taxes a couple points. That might make the difference with travel and per diem and all that to keep us from moving Ugly Betty to New York, where they're giving a 35% break, because the real savings might only be a few points because you have to pay a lot more money to go there, and it's a lot easier. And once the movies were moving to New York, it was like, this is a little ridiculous. It used to be the most expensive. When we were shooting Elf, it was more expensive to shoot there than it was to shoot here. We only couldn't shoot 2 weeks there. And in Canada, it was cheaper yet. Well, now with the weak dollar, it actually makes sense to shoot in the States, but we're losing business to other states. And I'm all for, I applaud them for having the tax breaks in the other states. I just, you know, selfishly moved to Hollywood because this was a dream, and this is, you got the best people in the world, the biggest talent pool, and you have great studios, great facilities, vendors. It's all built around here, and it's like, to me, it's like Flint, Michigan, you know. It was a boom town, and they never thought it could end, and it did. Unfortunately, once, because the economy is bad and outsourcing here, the movie business has never been better, and we're not moving to other countries. We're moving to other states. So it just seems very short-sighted. And I've been talking to the governor. He's trying to get the, you know, he's trying to get this budget passed. So I don't think politically it's a big state. I think it's like, it used to be the fifth largest economy in the world. I think it's like the ninth now. You can't get a government that big to all agree to cutting taxes for Southern California because they'll see it as giving in. Right now they're trying to pass a budget, so I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. But regardless of whether it is or not, I refuse to make a movie if it's not here, and if I ever get to the point where I can't make movies here, I'll make television shows here, and if not, I'll, you know, live off my 401k.
John Lasseter mentioned that Disney is now a filmmaker-oriented studio. And how do you find the work of Marvel Studios? Is it executive-oriented, filmmaker-oriented, and how did that affect the decision-making process on the patents?
Well, it's a small shop, so that helps. There's not layers and layers of executives, which, no matter how good they're well intentioned they are, very difficult. And above those few executives, there was like a Wall Street board of directors. So it wasn't a group of people who, like, we know how to make movies. You had the people who controlled the money, who trusted the people that they had hired, and those people that they hired, it was a small group, and they're, you know, like Kevin Feige's a producer on the film and cares deeply and ultimately knows how to get us what we need because it's such a small shop. You don't have crazy deep pockets like a studio, so it was more like a negative pickup, but I come from that world. I just knew I couldn't be over budget and I'd be fine. I had a lot of freedom because the things I care about are typically what they don't care about in superhero movies, the dialogue, the characters, the emotion. They cared more about the action and fulfilling what audiences have come to expect from a Marvel film. Of course, they want a good film, but even if they didn't have a good film, they knew they would cover their bet. And being the first movie in the studio, that was very important to them. Now, because it was so well received, there's even more enthusiasm and support for me and for Robert. So in that case, it's good. But on the other hand, I involve them at every step of the way. I don't lock them out of the editing room. I don't lock them out of the writing room. They're next to me. They're my partners. So I don't know if it's the relationship I have with them, that they have with me, the fact that it's Kevin, and we just click very well. But I've had more freedom on this movie of whatever the budget was, $140, $150 million. I had more freedom on this than with a $5 million budget. This has been the most freedom I've ever experienced, so I'm very happy here.
Some of us were at Stan Winston Studios yesterday and we saw the we saw the Ironmonger, and there was talk of the War Machine, the sequel. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
I want to do it. We're drawing War Machine. We're figuring it out. Talking to Terrence. See if he could take some time out of his new life as a musician to be War Machine. I think Terrence was, and the character of Brody was smaller in the first movie than we had anticipated. But that's how it worked for the movie. That was the best to tell that story with the origin story. He spent half the movie in the cave. But it does set the table very well for this character. And War Machine's fun. Again, you look for ways to up the ante.
Yeah.
It's tough to up the ante on the villain side without going into strange territories. But what we can do is really have a lot of fun with our family, our main characters. And that includes myself. I expect to have more to do in this one. otherwise, I will walk. And we have certainly Rhodey and Gwyneth. Really, I mean, it's the best work I've ever seen her do. For me, for my taste. I know she's won Oscars and stuff, and she's a pretty good actor. But for me, I like her. I thought she had great chemistry with Robert. Of course, Robert we'll see more of, and. and then we'll see how it all, you know, how that group, that basic group of four people, moves forward towards the inevitable Avengers that are, that's coming, and how the Mandarin starts to, how largely he looms in this next one. Those, these are the types of things we're doing, but mostly from a perspective of tone, mostly from a perspective of, it's like sitting around making a mixtape. Remember those? I guess it's playlists now. You'd make a mixtape for your friend, and you'd sit there and you'd say, oh, this song, this will get the party going. I like to DJ. I've started DJing. I actually just DJed Robert's son's party. That was a favor I did for him. And, of course, I like all old rap music and stuff. All the things I wished I could DJ when I was younger, and now I get to do all. You know how, you know, like people get Porsches?
Yeah.
I got turntables. So that's my midlife crisis. And I'm really nervous to play his son's party. And the 15-year-old's going to think I'm cool. But it is like that. Like, you want to do, you want to get the party going. There's some, there's a feeling about, if you have the mixtape that you, that your friends say, oh, give us your mixtape because the party's going good, and you pop it in and let's play it again. There's a buzz I get off of that. I don't know if it's everybody. I think it's kind of a universal thing. And there, whether you go in a Comic-Con and showing footage, or you're making a movie and putting it out there. And that's why I love going to the Arrow Theater and doing the live commentary and talking to people. And Robert came by on a lark. That was sort of, I DJed his kid's party. I said, you got to come show up for my event. He went up on stage. We talked. He loves it, too. We would go to the, what is it, the Arclight for the midnight shows and intro the shows. And we loved it. We really did. And, like, the people are like, from the studio are like, oh, that's very smart. It's going to generate buzz. I'm like, yeah, well, we, you know, literally, I would be doing it when I couldn't, when it, people didn't know who I was, when it was Rudy, I would go to three shows in a row, sit in the back of the theater and just listen to people, listen to the crowd.
So one thing that keeps the party on the move is that in the suit. Were you totally satisfied with the results of the final Mark III?
Of the suit?
Yeah, and should we expect more groundbreaking research on that? What would you expect from the suit?
I don't want to make it too complicated with the plot. I don't want to ask people to follow something I wouldn't be able to follow. And so there are certain, I think there's emotional complexity we're going to find with the characters, but not plot complexity. Because I don't want people to have to do their homework to see the movie. I want you to go in and say, okay, I kind of remember who he was, who that was, what that was. I'm going to bring you up to speed in the movie and tell a fun story. But you do need to add complexity. And so where I want to add complexity is emotionally, as far as the tech goes, as far as the look goes, up the ante in smart ways that you may notice or may not. So if you're a fan, you're going to see that the suit has changed more, that the HUD has changed, that he's making breakthroughs and innovation. What has happened since he said, I am Iron Man? What does that really mean? That's another one of those things where it's like, hey, that's a good idea on the day. Kevin Feige's like, we've never done it before. It'll be great. I said, I don't know if it'll be good. Yeah, it'll be good. We do it. Everybody loves it. It's like, okay, what's the next movie now? You know? But I like it because it further defines us away from Batman, which is, you know, they've got their end of the playground and they could have it. You know, I don't want to, it's like a prison yard. You know, you get the monkey bars. I'm gonna stay by the, I'll hang up by the toilets, you know. And as long as you sort of steer clear of each other, there's enough room, there's enough for everybody. But the last thing I want to do is run and try to, you know, punch the biggest guy in the nose when I get locked up. You know, that's not how it works. You steer clear, you let them do their thing, you do your thing, and there's enough for everybody. And I'm a fan of their work. I don't know how they feel about Iron Man, but I really thought that they broke a lot of ground with Dark Knight, that the use of IMAX was mind-blowing. I was sitting next to James Cameron, actually, in a screening, and we were sitting there before the thing started. I said, well, I guess they letterboxed the thing for the IMAX. I think they probably, what is it, like 16 by 9, but just big? Like, yeah, yeah. And then the first shot comes on of the helicopter shot of the city, and it's the entire wall. And me and him were like, wow. And it was like, I mean, that's probably what people felt like when they first went to a movie theater. What it feels like when you go see an IMAX establishment. Because the establishing shots are interesting. I mean, I sat through that long movie, no problem. Because I'm looking at, you know, visually, it's, there's always something interesting to look at. Not to mention Heath's performance, but.
You would, sorry.
Go ahead.
You talked earlier about your love of long form and television, and uh-huh. mentioned it a little bit before. Is that something you hope to do or want to do?
I'll end up doing it eventually.
And do you have a thought of what genre you would prefer?
I don't know. It depends what I'm curious about at the time. You know, I would think of something about like families and couples and raising kids, but I'm writing a script now called Couples,
right.
You know, or Couples Retreat for Vince, where I'm sort of exploring that. So it's whatever is of interesting to me at that moment. I don't think I would want to do it just as a... I mean, look, if there's people that I would collaborate with who are great and I would sort of shoot the pilot and be a little bit involved, that's one level of involvement. That's fine. That's usually how directors get involved with projects. I'm talking about really getting in there and writing all the scripts and overseeing the whole thing and not doing anything else. I just don't see that as available to me right now. But I think eventually I will, because that's the way you... It's like Larry David. He never crosses the 405. You know, he shoots it. He writes. He sits around. It's a lot of work. People see who they are. But he's already done... He's made his mark. He's made his money. And he's enjoying success in this, but I think it was because he was just following his bliss. And so I think eventually I'll do something sort of small, LA-based, where you could explore 13 or 22 episodes, maybe cable, maybe TV. I like animation, too. That's an easier thing, because you could actually... It's like racing a snail. as long as the rabbit doesn't fall asleep, you'll get there. So animation and stop motion animation is very, very compelling to me. And I've been talking to the guys from Seth Green and those guys about collaborating on something either for television or for film. So, but I found that my biggest problem is overextending myself, and I get a little log jammed, and I just want to enjoy this moment and this time and not push myself too hard. And I haven't learned how to do that yet.
We should limit the questions at this point. So one here, one there. Yeah.
You were very hands-on reaching out to fans.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that leaked or was revealed early mm-hmm. on. How are you changing this time around environment?
We're not. You know... I think it worked out. The big thing is you don't care if somebody leaks or something, if somebody knows something. You care about if it hurts the movie. So Marvel knows if you're getting to the point where something's going to probably get leaked soon, release a photo, steal the thunder, get a good, well-lit shot as opposed to some cell phone shot that somebody else will take. You don't want to ruin the nature of it. You know, Transformers was incredibly successful, but if you remember early on, there were photos that leaked out, and everybody was like, what's this? That's what the movie looks like? I missed a phone call from a naked woman, apparently. So you have to learn how to deal with the rhythms of the internet, but I'll take it any day over people not caring, and that's what drove us. That Comic-Con bootleg video was the first anybody saw, and it was really fun. It was like they couldn't quite make it out, and they were trying like hell to get it down. It just took them a while, and I'm like, why are you even trying? It's like a good thing. Like, no, you know, we have to take it down. It's not, you know. I'm like, okay, we'll put up a clean version. And then eventually they put up a clean version on like the Apple site. But it wasn't nearly as fun as when you heard the crowd over the cell phone and you know, so I know kind of what it is. I don't get disappointed and frustrated when it's just the nature of things, you know. I'm more scared about what's going to happen with DVD revenue in 5 years. I just got Apple TV. I see what's coming. It's a new world, and that might undermine the whole business model. That's concerning about technology. But as far as the fans, I'm not worried about the fans. The fans, it's a huge water cooler that everybody's talking around. And with all this stuff, Twitter and all, everybody's with their little blogs and their conversations in real time. I mean, people knew about Iron Man before that panel was out in Comic-Con, because people were there on their laptops. So that is incredible. That's grassroots. That's mobilizing. That's like, you know, it's what's happening in the political system. It's here to stay, and embrace it. Don't be scared and frustrated. Try to stop it. It's like trying to stop the tide. And I think that I'm one of the few guys out there that really gets it. I mean, Zach does, too. Clearly, he's getting something going with 300 and The Watchmen and that dialogue. But it's not, you can't just hide and say you're not going to do press if you're a director. Not for this kind of movie. You're one of the guys. You're one of the stars, you know. You got to be out there and you got to be promoting it. And people, you should be happy people are curious to ask you this kind of stuff. And fortunately, I come from a background where I did have to promote things as an actor, where it doesn't freak me out. I actually like it. And I like to be able to speak about something that I'm actually having something to do with making and not just a character I'm playing and talking about. You know, the shit I kept in my pocket when I performed for my acting motivation, or, you know what I mean, or how many times I spray tanned. Anyone else? What was that?
I wanted to know, with the worldwide success of the film, you obviously had a 140, 150 budget with the first one. How has the budget possibly changed, and how has that changed the writing process for, say, some of the actions that he's...
Very interesting question.
And I have one more. You mentioned the Dark Knight playing on one side of the playground and on the other side. But it was just jaw-dropping, that IMAX stuff. As a filmmaker, are you even thinking, shit, we might want to do that too?
I would love to do some IMAX stuff. I think that's going to be a game changer. I would love to do some of it on IMAX, for IMAX. It's all a matter of dollars and cents for them. I would also love to do 3D. I think 3D for this one, I would love to do 3D. Because just think of the HUD. Just think of that virtual space and what that would be like. The layers, what you could get away with, how much fun it could be. And it also drives people to see it in the theater. It makes that much more of an experience. But it all comes down to how much does it cost and what do they get for it. And I can, you know, my leverage only goes so far with technical issues like that. That being said, as far as the budget goes, you know, Fox's way of doing it has always been keep the budget the same. The above the line gets bigger and bigger because you got to entice those people to come back, and so you squeeze out what the movie is. And I think if you look at the sequel to Fox superhero movies, you see that, you know, a trained eye could see that they're more cost conscious as the series goes on. The other end of the spectrum was the Spider-Man series, where, you know, I've not read any reports of the budget of the third Spider-Man film that are in line with what my understanding is that it was. In other words, they're trying to hide how much money they're spending because it could become such a sinkhole. Fortunately, that was an incredibly profitable film, and it made sense and made money, and now they want to do two more. So I'm not saying that they don't know what they're doing. Both companies clearly know how to make money, but they're two different approaches, and I think they both have their shortcomings. Ideally, we'd love to find a way where you have, you know, clearly it costs you more money to keep everybody in, and as well it should. If there's success, you should reward the people that have helped you, you know, get that success. And if there are vendors and people that you're going to work, you should, ideally they shouldn't have to prove themselves over and over again, and everybody should get a fair price for their work. And then if there are new people who want to come on, you're taking a chance, you pay them accordingly. But the bottom line is, for the people going to the theater, you have to reward them with something better, or at least try to make something better than you did the last time around. It's very hard to do that with less money. The question is, do you just let it go out of control? I don't know. I think you hit a point of diminishing return. And certainly as a filmmaker, I don't mind working with constraints. And there's going to be a greater efficiency because we know how to do it. We double paid for certain things. We shot certain things in a suit, and then we did it in CG. There's no reason to do both. And hopefully I could avoid that in the future. But by the same token, this is Tony Stark's world. This is like James Bond. It's got to feel big, and he's got to feel rich, and he's got to feel real. So that costs money. And then the action has to be more than what we had last time. So Marvel has said to me that they're certainly not going to try to save money on this one. They're not going down the Fox road on this, and that's encouraging. Now, how far they're going to go with it? I think that becomes... Look, if I was running the show, I wouldn't say... There's clearly an amount of money they have that they talk amongst themselves, and the good news is they're not hitting me with a budget. What they're saying is, let's get the best script we can and let's look at it. But everybody knows they're going to make another one of these, and so it becomes more of a conversation. As opposed to most films where it's like, you're not going to get your green light if you don't do this. They clearly want to do with me, with Robert, and for 2010. So it's a new experience. I haven't gone through it before, but it worked out well last time, which was probably a lot more challenging than in success what this time will be, especially when you see, you know, this. We made over $300 million, which doesn't seem to be an anomaly. The Dark Knight made $500 million. So there's clearly an audience for this type of movie, and I think that makes them comfortable, and I think the real winner is the fan. So in supporting these movies, the fan has ensured that you're going to have another crop of well-made sequels.
Cool.
I've got one short one on radio for you.
Quick announcement for those going to Stan Winston Studios, be in the lobby by no later than 25 past, because it'll leave at 5:30. And I want to thank everyone for coming, and especially the domestic press this time. And congratulations. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
John, you mentioned the tech.
I've got an interview here.
Sorry. Roller skates.
And I'm gonna ask, does this freak you out as much as it freaks me out? We saw that at the studio yesterday.
We could have really gotten him into a lot of trouble with that thing. Because that's a mask that the stuntman would wear, and it was very realistic. So it's like, where should we take this mask? Where could we put him? We could have put him in bed with somebody. We could have had him asleep on, you know, in a dry lake bed.
Hey, John, any ideas for cameos like The Shield in the second movie?
We're going to do some fun stuff. I can't say. My God, we got 2 years. You'll figure it all out.
Come on, give me the clue.
We ran out the clock last time. You know, we released it without... All the preview screenings didn't have the Shield scene.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
And people were like mad. They're like, I know it's there. Like, I don't believe it. They're doing something. Like, they were so sure that even with doing that, they were like, they're doing something funny. Because I know for sure it's in there.
A lot of people didn't believe in the hook as well. And then they stayed till the end to see, but of course there was nothing. But just
well, that scene was supposed to be at the end. With Tony.
Oh.
And they stuck it at the end of the movie, which is weird.
Yeah.
That was like the last minute they did that. Oh.
So did Chicago names Melissa Picelli and Jane Alderman?
Jane Alderman does, yeah.
Yeah. Melissa, Circuit Court, Cook County. Did you work with them?
Yeah, I did work with them. What's your name? Picelli?
Melissa Picelli.
Don't remember the name, but I did cartoon work for the Circuit Court.
Okay. Yeah, we did the Fairy Trails tour around.
Oh, you did that too?
Did that, yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
John, the bigger thing we need to get with you, are you ever tempted to do some sort of honors here in improv? Because I'm an improv junkie.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
No, but when we shoot, it very much is like an improv thing. And when I direct, I'm like an improv coach.
Right.
Try this, try saying this. Okay, you come here. You know, it's more like a sports coach than the director. So I definitely use it in my writing all the time.
Yeah.
I don't want to reach over your food. I'm that quarter right there.
Sure, this one?
Yeah.
Thanks, John.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
I was going to also... Oh, what the hell? I was going to ask you, though, I just got the Blu-ray in the mail and the DVD, and I'm curious, because the way that those movies come together with, and you have to make them so far in advance, is there a lot of stuff sitting around that you're thinking for the next edition, or did you really throw everything at it?
We did a lot of stuff. There's no commentary, though. That's a bummer. No, I didn't get to do a commentary.
So that's basically for when Iron Man 2 comes out and they do the new deluxe Iron Man DVD.
I think on Blu-ray, they were saying on Blu-ray, we might be able to add it.
Oh, via like a download?
Yes. So there's talk of that. I don't know enough about Blu-ray. I don't really know that much, but that's what Marvel said. I said I was really bummed out. I really wanted to do a commentary track, but they literally gave me one date and I was getting a hernia operation. So that didn't work out well.
Right.
But I do want to do one, and maybe we'll do it with the Blu-ray. Maybe we'll find a way to download it for free. I don't know. We'll do something.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Cool. Technology.